We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.
Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 29 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Plotting Wheat's Way Forward, about attending several of Washington State University's cereal variety testing program field days. Given that the Washington Grain Commission funds the cereal variety testing program to the tune of $175,000 a year, my boss, Glenn Squires, likes each of his staff and himself to attend several WSU field days each summer. This year, I went to field days in Ritzfield, Harrington, and Reardon. Each testing location is a bit different and the same. Some have only winter varieties, some winter and spring. They're also different because which winter varieties are planted depends upon the rainfall zone the nursery is located in, although there is a lot of overlap. They're the same because at 19 of the testing program sites, the role of interpreting results to farmers falls to Ryan Higginbotham, director of the Cereal Variety Testing Program. This is his third year at the helm. The crop looks great this year, but given what happened last year, nobody in eastern Washington is exactly relaxed. What happened last year was widespread falling numbers discounts that occurred because of a cold temperature shock in June that triggered late maturity alpha amylase activity. In addition, some rain events caused pre-harvest sprouting. When I spoke with WSU spring wheat breeder Mike Pumphrey last year at the St. John Field Day, he was uneasy about the weather specifically because of falling number concerns. His unease proved correct. He was also worried about falling numbers when I talked to him at the Reardon plot tour on June 28th.
I think the jury's still out, but the weather patterns we've had here in mid-June do raise me a little bit of concern about, the temperature swings we've had between mid-90s or even 100 degrees in some areas, followed by nighttime lows down in the 40s. And those are the conditions that if the crop is at the, I'd say, the right or the wrong stage, however you want to look at it, of maturity, we could be looking at problems again with falling numbers across, various parts of the state.
Are the conditions the same?
I haven't looked at the exact numbers and the means and the daytime highs and lows to date, but just intuitively, I feel like especially the past week, this week of the fourth week of June, has been quite similar to some of the conditions we had last year that also raised me concern. So, like I said, I can't predict it perfectly, but I think there are crops at the right stage of maturity to be affected by this problem, and the weather we've had is kind of textbook conditions for having the problem.
And let's just talk about the weather. So you're looking at morning lows and afternoon highs?
Late maturity alpha amylase specifically is induced by these sort of rapid and I would say extreme temperature changes. So when we're going from 90 degrees in the daytime to the next night only being 42 or 45 degrees, within a several day window, that those kind of changes are what induce LMA.
Is there anything farmers can do during harvest to somehow deal with the risk?
In at harvest time, the biggest thing you can do is timely harvest operations. And I know growers are already completely committed to that, but rain is their biggest risk. It's too late for the LMA. The story is done. But rain is the biggest risk. We've considered or talked to people about, cutting varieties separately, testing, some fields to see so that they, if they can segregate or bin and reduce those losses, blending a good crop with a bad crop is not a good situation. So taking some time to test the variety, keeping varieties bin separately, maybe keeping fields that were planted at different times, headed at different times, were subject to different weather conditions at these vulnerable stages, trying to, within reason, keep those segregated or at least evaluated. Yeah, they might tell them something a way that they can save some value in their grain.
Given that we're in such a rush at harvest, do you think that country elevators are going to have the opportunity to have growers come in and have their samples tested for LMA before they actually get into their fields big time?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. You know, the State Department of Agriculture has really ramped up their testing capabilities. They've hired additional seasonal labor. They are running way more samples than they've ever run before, but there's still a lot of samples to process, and that's why there's been those 1 week, 2 week, you know, backlogs. Long-term, looking forward, we're really hoping that we can come up with a tool for the industry that allows a more rapid testing to give a quick indicator kind of at harvest delivery time or at grain delivery time so that they can make those decisions. But for now, I think that the time it takes to run the test and the number of tests being run across the state is still going to be a limitation to that.
Called to answer a question from among the 25 or so farmers in attendance, Pumphrey made it clear that he and Camille Stieber, the Agricultural Research Service scientist conducting falling numbers research, were committed to finding a solution. But fixes will not come quickly.
I'll brag on myself and Camille. You probably won't find two people like more interested in sorting out the truth versus selling a specific seed or variety. I know I'm a breeder for a university that gets royalties, but I don't really care about, you know, I'm trying to figure out what's best. And so Camille is very meticulous and detail-oriented, and she wants to find out what the cause is, not just put out a random number that's uninterpretable. We're trying to do that, and that's probably part of why it's slow, is that we'll go, okay, this location's weird. Let's cut 50 seeds of every variety in half for that location and then do a whole other test and figure out if there's enzyme in the front of the seed or the back of the seed. Was it PHS or was it LMA? And all those things take time. These are tedious, monotonous tasks that we're trying, and we'll keep trying.
Now, back to our original programming. You're going to hear talk ahead about lines and varieties. Line is short for experimental line, in that it hasn't been released to be grown. A variety is a line that has been released, although it takes 2 or 3 years after release to build up enough seed so that it becomes widely available. I've been attending Higginbotham's field days since his first year on the job, and while he was no slouch even then, he has grown even more confident in his presentation. Altogether, I've been attending field days for more than 30 years and have always thought more farmers should take advantage of the opportunity. It seems to me one of the shared characteristics of successful farmers and seedsmen is that at field days, they are the ones who go into the plots and kneel down in the dirt to study the leaves or head of some experimental line that has caught their eye. Higginbotham may be employed by WSU, but he calls them like he sees them. If there is a good private variety, he doesn't shirk from calling it good. And if there is a poor WSU variety, he doesn't shirk from calling it a dog either. Well, okay, correction. He doesn't call anything dogs, but when he gets to the third or fourth drawback of a particular line, the picture of a dog is drawn. The Ritzville and Harrington field days were windless, perfect for recording Higginbotham for a podcast. Alas, I only got my act together in time for the Reardon field day, and there was a light breeze blowing. I've attempted to clean up the sound of wind blowing over a microphone, but it's nothing that's going to win me an Oscar. I don't like the wind. I have never been a comfortable public speaker. I like to think I do it well enough when called upon, but standing before a crowd, looking at all the faces looking at me, expecting something of value, yikes. I make a better podcaster. Which is why I'm always impressed by individuals who appear so natural addressing groups of people. Though he confesses to be nervous the first minute or so until he has hit his stride, Higginbotham is one of those folks who makes public speaking look easy. He probably has FFA to thank for that. He received his American FFA degree in 1999. The year he graduated from WSU with a BS in Crop Science in 2001, he was named Outstanding Student in Agriculture. In 2003, he received his Master's in Plant Breeding and Genetics at WSU and then worked as a technician for several years within both the university's spring and winter wheat breeding programs. All that, and he's an Eastern Washington farm kid, Elmira specifically. I caught Higginbotham for a moment between the winter and spring variety presentations at the Reardon Field Day. I asked him how he felt about his presentation with nearly 3 years of practice under his belt.
I'm getting better. I still have to carry around my notes, but I'm much more confident in the winter lines. The spring lines, I tend to peek at my notes a little more often.
Do you put together some kind of a cheat sheet as you are starting this during the year?
The initial start out of each tour is pretty well the same. So I highlight, you know, what the program is, why it's important, talk about quality for wheats. And then I put together a cheat sheet. It takes time and it's a lot of work because it's in plot order so I can navigate the trials. But just some details, information I have about each line, and then it's location specific. So I'd have a sheet for all of my high rainfall soft white winter trials, for example, but then at the tour at, say, for example, Mayview, I would go through and make some notes about that particular site the week before, the day before, looking at last year's data, looking over my notes from what I've seen in the field this year, looking through the disease ratings to try and make sure that I'm giving people information that's specific to that location.
I'm always grateful when Higginbotham uses his introductory remarks to talk about the preferred variety brochure and the necessity farmers keep quality in mind when planting varieties. This is what he says about quality at each of his 19 presentations.
The other thing you received out front was the preferred varieties brochure. I think most of you are getting familiar with seeing this each year. It's an annual publication done by the Washington, Oregon, and Idaho Grain Commissions. And what it does is it ranks varieties based on end-use quality. So I know that a lot of you folks have the opinion that you don't get paid for quality, and to a certain degree there's some truth to that, but as a region, we do get paid for producing good quality wheat. There's a lot of cheap wheat available in the world, and people could find that elsewhere, and we'll buy it elsewhere if we don't produce it. So as a region, our wheat sells at a premium because it's good quality. I understand that yield is still king, and when you're making choices on what to plant on your farm, all I ask is that if you've got a couple of lines that are comparable, it would work equally well that you choose the one that's ranked higher up on that list for quality. And in that doing so, we can continue to elevate the quality of our overall crop and maintain that market share. Also forgot on the front of that page, the two names below mine, Vadim Jitkov and Andrew Horton, are the guys that work for me in the program, so they really do the majority of the work, and I just spend my time walking around talking to people. So I appreciate them and want to acknowledge them every chance I get in front of folks.
Higginbotham's presentations always include information about when the plots were planted and with what kind of drill. For the uninitiated, a drill is the device that delivers the seed into the ground. A cross-slot drill is a type of direct seeding implement which seeds into the previous crop's residue. Higginbotham doesn't mince words when it comes to his feelings about this particular implement. Luckily, the Washington Grain Commission has funded a new direct seed plot drill for his program.
This was planted September 19th, and we used our no-till drill, which I really don't like. We've got a new one that's been remodeled and ready for pickup that we'll be able to use this fall and next spring. This was planted with our cross-slot drill. The new one's going to have hoe openers. The one that we use currently, it's got some issues, so the new one's really going to be beneficial for us, and the Grain Commission provided funds to do that, so thanks for that and being able to upgrade that drill. At planting time, we put down 100 pounds of N, 14 phos and 14 sulfur at planting with our drill. In the spring, soil test showed 268 pounds of N in the 4-foot profile and 49 pounds of sulfur in the 2-foot. So we did not add any extra fertilizer to the trial. This was sprayed by cooperators on, well, somewhere around the first week of May. I don't know the exact date, but it did receive fungicide at that point with the herbicide application, and then received a second application just last week. So I'm not seeing rust. When I walked through here this morning, I doubt we're going to see a whole lot. So it's been given every opportunity to perform well here. So it's been managed real well, and I appreciate these guys taking care of that.
By the way, the Reardon Variety Testing Nursery is located on Hal Johnson's farm. Johnson was a Washington Grain Commissioner for many years.
The other thing to note is that in the soil sample this spring, the pH in the top 6 inches was only 5.04. So it was getting down there a little low. Exchangeable aluminum in that top 6 inches was at 44 parts per million. So that's enough to see some injury in it. In hindsight, I wonder if that's not why some of the L-tan types didn't look very good to me this spring. They just kind of laid there, looked a little yellow, and that could be the reason. I don't believe L-tan does real well with that low pH soil, and so that might be why I saw some of that. And most of it's kind of outgrown it, You might still see a little thinner plots of some of those lines, but just so you know, I think that's, can't verify it for certain, but I think that that's what was going on with some of those.
The low soil pH that Higginbotham was addressing is becoming a real issue in eastern Washington. Here's more of what he said about L10 when he arrived at a plot where it had been planted.
Okay, right next to it's L10, and it's a, kind of a sickly looking plot, I think. And in part, I wonder if it's some of that low pH. It has not looked good all year. So even from the spring on, it was kind of stunted and yellowish looking. You know, I don't think L10 is probably an ideal soy sub here. It probably fits in some certain areas and in some certain ways. You know, but winter hardiness is great. Soil resistance is great. It is susceptible to foot rots and very susceptible to rust. Now, there was a point not too long ago where you didn't have to worry about the rust on L10. If you're growing L10 or anything, I shouldn't say anything, things that have a lot of L10 in their background, you're going to want to monitor it for rust because the L10's had a lot of stripe rust this year.
If you want to learn more about the problems and solutions to low soil pH, go back and listen to episode 8, where I dug into the issue during a conversation with three Northwest soil pH experts. It's called Low Soil pH, episode 8. Many, but not all of you listening, have been to a WSU field day. For those who haven't, let me set the scene. Most field days are either held in the late afternoon or in the early morning for obvious reasons. The Reardon field day started at 7 a.m. We assembled by the side of the road and then walked about 25 yards into a field where a series of 5x12-foot plots of growing wheat were neatly spaced with 4-foot alleys mowed between each range or block of varieties or lines and a mowed space for people to stand in front of the nursery. There are a lot of plots because as many as 50 single varieties or lines are replicated 3 times in different positions. That means there are at least 150 to keep track of in any winter wheat nursery and more than 8,000 across the program. Occasionally, there's an experimental line or variety that looks like it's going to be a barn burner. It's the Kentucky Derby equivalent of a thoroughbred that bursts out of the gates and takes the inside line. Hopes are high. And then, for one reason or another, mostly weather, the nag doesn't live up to its original potential. Which is why Higginbotham asks farmers to study the years of data he spends hours putting together. He used the example of the variety Masami as one that has widely varying performance over the last couple of years.
Masami has been around for a while from WSU, and Masami, the thing I mentioned about Masami this year is a word of caution to avoid making decisions based on 1 year of data. So in 2015, a Masami topped my trials in the less than 12-inch rainfall zone, had the best average across locations, and then last year, the same locations, it was dead last. So complete flip-flop.
20 years ago, variety testing program nurseries were filled with almost all public institution varieties, meaning WSU, Oregon State University, and the University of Idaho. There were no privates, meaning companies like Monsanto, Syngenta, or Limagrain testing lines in the program. Nowadays, about 50% of the varieties are being developed by so-called privates, and there's even some new ones I haven't heard of, along with local companies bringing in varieties from outside the country.
This KWS line comes from a program just called KWS is the company name. So they're a European-based breeding program. They've set up shop in the Midwest. They gave me an entry last year. They gave me this one this year. I did see a lot of rust on this a couple locations. You know, most of these have been sprayed, so it's hard to kind of tell where it's susceptible and where it's not. But it's pretty weak strawed. So it tends to fall down, especially as we move up in rainfall. We'll see how it yields this year. The last one on the first range here is Mandala. This is an entry from to the Eastern European line submitted by Tri-State Seed Company. They own the rights to this and a couple of others. We had it in our irrigated-only trial last year. This year I've got it at all my locations. It survived the winter better than I expected. So last year in the irrigated, see how it does under a rain-fed situation.
Full disclosure, Dana Herron, who serves on the Washington Grain Commission, is a partner in Tri-State Seed. Mandela is a hard red winter and KWS a soft white winter. It just so happens that one of the best soft white varieties in the Reardon nursery is also a WSU variety, Puma, released by Aaron Carter in 2013. But while Higginbotham gave that release a big thumbs up, He was equally harsh when it comes to another WSU variety that nevertheless continues to perform for some growers.
The Puma, if you look long-term, very, very good long-term average. I think it's, if it's not the top, it's tied for the top at both of my 12 to 16 inch and less than 12 inch rainfall zones. Does have some foot rot resistance. Rust resistance is good, in particular good adult plant resistance, so you might see a little bit in the seedling stage. It is going to be a little taller, so it and the Duet are generally two of the taller lines in the soft trowel. Spot strength is not a big concern, but you know, I wouldn't put it under irrigation and not treat it with a growth regulator because it is going to get tall. Have a great yield potential across the intermediate and lower rainfall zones. Somebody asked me yesterday to compare Puma and Zirpa. Yield potential, you know, there's not a whole lot of difference. The rust resistance, of course, is much better in Puma. And then in terms of the snow mold, they're about the same. So I think everybody's familiar with Zirpa. It's acceptable, but not at the top. And Puma is going to fit the same bill, same with the Northwest U.S. So there's not a lot of difference in terms of the snow mold and winter hardiness. You guys know that you're going to have to monitor the Zirpa for stripe rust. You know it gets physiological leaf spot. It's susceptible to foot rot. It is least desirable quality. But again, the problem is it still yields really well.
I urge landlords, agribusiness owners, and yes, more farmers to make it a point in the future to attend the cereal variety testing program in their area. Information is king in our society, and you can't go wrong getting more of it. That's it for episode 29, or what I'm calling Plotting Wheat's Way Forward. Hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll tune in again for another episode of Wheat All About It.
Don't like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's chilling. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You wanna be a hypocrite? Just forget to have the shit. We feed you.